This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast, episode number 268 this week. We're back with part two of our conversation with dog trainer and hunting guide, Maddie Rawlinson. We will talk to Maddie in just a few moments. Thanks as always to Patreon supporters of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making voluntary contributions in support of the show. We'll have another Onyx Elite subscription card up for grabs to all patrons at the end of the month. They get access to some bonus content and the Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers. If you want to be eligible for all that, the best way to do so is to go to patreon.com/birdshot. All right, don't forget to rate and review the podcast. Subscribe, like, follow, share an episode, tell a friend. Whatever you can do in the podcast player that you are listening on. Those are all additional ways you can help support the show and ensure these episodes keep coming your way. So thank you for taking the time to do that as well. All right, we're going back to the Birdshot Podcast inbox. Got an email from frequent listener Chris, who also happens to be the proud owner of an Upland Gun Company Venus 28 gauge. He's a grouse hunter. And Chris writes, "Hope all is well, Nick. Wanted to say thanks again for some helpful advice on taking a very young pup into the woods this past season. I was able to get my pup 20-ish days in the grouse woods during hunting season. She learned a lot. Patience from long car rides, and waiting her turn in the woods, getting comfortable in dense vegetation, tree stands, checking in, etc. I was even able to get her gun broke by the time the season ended, at which point she was only 5.5 months old. She is now 8 months old and has become more physically and mentally capable, having me wish that I had 3.5 months for more woods walks now." Overall, she did and continues to do great. The one major item that needs to yet click are the birds. Even now, at 8 months old, she doesn't seem to be actively searching for grouse. I have run her several times in the woods postseason, given the mild winter. It's more that she stumbles upon them, flushes them, and then chases the flush. I realize she is still a puppy with limited experience on birds, and that most likely she will advance during the 2024-25 season. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on this. My situation does not allow me to use pigeons for training, only dummies and wild birds when I am up north at the cabin. Did you do any formal bird training with Hartley or Rose, or did you just take them hunting and let the point tracking, etc., develop naturally? When hunting over them as young pups, when did you shoot at birds? Only when pointed? To be clear, I am in no rush on having a fully developed hunting dog by this fall. I just want to gather opinions on how others have done it. All right, so as most of you probably know listening to this show, I am not a dog trainer. I am a DIY bird hunter that has attempted to learn what I need to know in order to develop and train my own hunting dogs. So because Chris was asking for some of my thoughts and opinions, I thought it would be good to share here on the episode, as it may be helpful to some others as well as Chris. So I'll try to break these out. I think the first part, he's just asking if I have any thoughts on sort of how his puppy is behaving. I think Chris kind of is answering his own question and effectively knows what's going on. He's got a young dog that has had some exposure and is showing progress, steps in the right direction, but isn't all the way there yet, which he knows and acknowledges. We're talking 8-month-old dog, first season under the belt. I think really that's about all that needs to be said on that end. You've had a great first season, hopefully got into a decent number of birds. It was a good fall last year. The weather was good. Conditions were good. 20 days in the grouse woods. That's some great exposure. And I think most importantly, some of the things he hit on early, the long car rides, waiting her turn, getting comfortable in the cover, all of that stuff is what you really want to be getting the dog comfortable with and acclimated to in season one. So that's a huge step in the right direction right there. And as long as things continue in that direction next year, Chris and his new pup should be well on their way. So I think he knows that, and that's my read on it as well. The next question was, did I do any formal bird training with Hartley or Rose, or did I mainly just take them hunting and let them develop naturally? With Hartley, I did more bird work, mainly because I kind of thought it was necessary. And so that was not really before his first season. He was pretty young. His first season was very much a puppy season. He was 3 months old or so. And all we did was exposure, basically. Got him in the woods and went for walks and kind of did those things that Chris did with his pup. Then after that was probably about the time I got connected with Jerry Havel out at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp and started taking trips out there and did some pigeon work and eventually got Hartley steadied up on pigeons, really steady to wing, I would say. We didn't do a whole lot of killing training birds or anything or getting him fully broke, that kind of thing. Mainly, I did that stuff. It was a great exercise for me. Again, I knew basically nothing. And so any exposure and experience I got was helpful. Fast forward 7 years later when I'm getting Rose, my second dog. By that time, I had sort of reached a point. I had seen enough with Hartley, and I had reached a point with him to where I knew what I was looking for out of my dogs. And I think I can say this now because Rose is going to be four. I think I had a pretty good idea that I was going to be able to accomplish that with pretty much wild birds. In the back of my mind, I'm always open to doing training scenarios and setting that kind of stuff up. But I don't do it here at home. Just don't exactly have the rights, or I haven't gone out of my way to set things up in that way. And I just don't seek that stuff out because I feel like I'm not in a position where I need to. So it just doesn't get prioritized, if that makes sense. It's not that I don't think it's good for the dog or that we would be better off doing some more formal bird training. I just consider myself fortunate enough to get my dogs into enough wild birds and hunt enough each fall to let them develop pretty much naturally. And I could say Rose has pretty much been, 99% developed naturally on wild birds. I think the only time I've worked her on pigeons was in the first summer when I went out to Pine Ridge and did bird intro. I mean, it was basically the most basic pigeon work bird training you could do with Rose, to do bird intro and intro to gun. And I don't think she's seen a pigeon since, other than when we go to Pine Ridge and she rips around the pigeon coop. But anyways, what does that say? What does that mean for Chris? I guess if you have the right dogs that have the genetics and high quality breeding, even an amateur like Nick can develop a pretty good hunting dog on wild birds. And again, keep in mind, I'm not guiding. I'm not a dog trainer. My standards are different than somebody else's standards, but I've been extremely satisfied with Rose's development in the grouse woods, to the point where if I could clone her today and have another one for next year, I would do that in a heartbeat. So take that for what it's worth. And then just to kind of sum that up, and I've talked about this a lot on the show, but I felt like I was a lot more hands-off with Rose than I was with Hartley because, again, just having gone through it once before, realizing where I was doing too much or just didn't need to be stressed out or worried about little details, I really took a more hands-off approach to Rose's development. And again, to this point, have been very, very pleased with what I've seen out of her. So into the next question, this was one of the interesting ones. When did you shoot at birds when you had the young pups? So that is one that, again, I've talked about a lot, whether or not you've heard me comment on that. With Hartley, I was very much mainly due to just a lack of understanding and sort of unrealistic expectations. I let a lot of birds fly away from Hartley in his first season or two that in hindsight, I now would have shot at. And that was, again, mainly because I just didn't know what was realistic to expect as far as steadiness, dog being staunch, and what I now consider to be good dog work versus a mistake or a bumped bird, ripped bird, all that sort of stuff. You could do a whole podcast on that. And if you want to hear a podcast on that, let me know. Well, we could always get somebody on and talk about that again. So despite my shortcomings, Hartley and I got through those early years and he turned into a fine bird dog. I still get lots of great bird work out of him. He knows what to do. He and Rose have their differences, which I really appreciate. And it's been cool to see, obviously, dogs one and two. So then again, skip ahead to Rose and her first season. Again, I'm more hands-off. I have a much better idea of what to look for, how to read a dog, how to watch a dog. Get 7 years under my belt, which, in the grand scheme of things, maybe not a lot, but that's still quite a bit. You know, you do anything for 7 years, you're going to probably learn a thing or two. So I'm in a much better place to read Rose's behavior and watch that. And what I felt I was able to do was watch her work those early birds and know whether or not she was being a team player, trying to point the birds, or whether she was being careless, reckless, getting too close and bumping a bird. Rose really did not do a whole lot of ripping of birds. Every dog's got to figure things out early on, but it was clear, and I knew this from talking to the breeder of Rose, Jerry Coulter, that these dogs were going to be quite pointy and want a point. And so that maybe that worked in my favor, but Rose really, really wanted to point birds from a very early age, and that just became clear. So, but she also wanted to use a term from a couple weeks ago with Craig Koshick, she wanted to be free on game. She wanted to stick with birds, follow scent, follow moving birds, and point them multiple times, which again, I have come to extremely appreciate now a few years into her development. But she did that in the first season to the point where I was blown away. Again, my second dog, hadn't seen a dog do that sort of stuff with that kind of consistency, and I was not expecting to see it in her first season, but she did. So I just felt like, to try to answer Chris's question, was she staunch like a statue for every bird that I shot in that first season? No, she was not. And that's where I felt like I got into, not into trouble, but it's just where I felt like I missed opportunities with Hartley, because I was expecting something that wasn't realistic for a dog of that age. With Rose, and maybe this will be different with my next hitter. Maybe my next hitter won't be as free on game as Rose is. I mean, you can never go wrong if the dog is staunch, standing still. But there are times when Rose is in motion that I allow her to be in motion, and I am in the game, if you will. I'm in range. We know there's a bird nearby. Her body language and pointing behavior is indicating that, but she is, again, free on that bird, moving, relocating, whatever term you want to use. I may flush the bird and I may shoot it. And I did that in the first season, and it worked for us. Now, I think what I would say is that while I was doing that, it was very much a bird-by-bird basis. So it's, let's say that happens one time and I shoot the bird. I am scrutinizing Rose's behavior on the next bird. You know, she's under a microscope a little bit just to see, did that affect her behavior moving forward? Did she then become more aggressive or more careless on the next bird? And as long as she didn't, which was pretty much the case, I continued to operate under those parameters, if that makes any sense. So it's not something that you can just say, again, that's where I sort of struggled with the blanket statement, only shoot pointed birds. I mean, I think if you want to play it safe, you can never go wrong with that advice, really. I mean, if the dog is staunch on point when the bird flushes, go ahead and shoot. If you don't feel like you have the ability or the experience to read a dog's behavior beyond that, then you don't need to shoot any other birds. But the risk is that if you have a dog that is maybe struggling to connect the dots or put the pieces together, you know, maybe you're missing an opportunity here and there to put a bird on the ground, get some feathers in its mouth, and fuel that drive to get them out there searching and on the hunt for the next bird, which is kind of what Chris was asking about. He had mentioned his dog didn't seem to be actively searching for grouse. So now I don't think I see anything in this email that suggests that he killed a grouse for this dog and put one on the ground for it. So it kind of plays into this situation here. If you went out for 20 days, it's hard to say without being there, seeing exactly what happened on some of those grouse contacts that the dog did have. Now, Chris runs a GoPro. I know that because we talk about GoPro stuff as well. So maybe he's got some clips he could share with me. But, you know, this could be a case where, you know, maybe it would have made sense to put a bird down that the dog was scenting in the vicinity of, didn't quite staunchly point, but also didn't see the bird or have an exact location on the bird and run straight into it. That's where I would personally, I would draw a line. If I felt that my dog knew where a bird was and was going in to that location like a flushing dog, I'm not going to shoot that bird. But if we remove that scenario and I've got a dog that is working scent and actively trying to point a grouse, but is perhaps in motion when myself and the dog's presence flush a grouse, that might be a bird I shoot depending on the circumstance. So there's a lot to chew on there. I am sure there are many, many thoughts and opinions on a topic like that. So feel free to share with me and add to the conversation if you choose. You can email me at nick@birdshotpodcast.com. Call up the breeder of your dog. Consult with a pointing dog trainer. If you're having trouble with that sort of stuff, there's plenty of people out there willing to help. But those are my thoughts, at least, which Chris was asking for. So again, thought I'd share them here on the podcast. Chris, keep hunting that dog. Keep giving it opportunities to find and point grouse. And I think you will continue making progress. And you should have a fun season on the horizon with the new pup. All right. Now, let's talk dog training with an actual dog trainer. We'll see what Maddie thinks. Let's welcome into the conversation and back to the Birdshot Podcast for part two of Heritage Gun Dogs, Maddie Rawlinson. All right, dude, we're back. How many species did you and the dogs get in front of last year?
Oh, God. Probably not as many as people would think, maybe. I was in Montana for the first part of the season last year. Yeah. So
sharptails, Huns. We're going to talk about your forest grouse adventures out there.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sharptails, Huns, sage grouse, pheasants, obviously. Yeah, and then the forest grouse, rough grouse, blue grouse. What else? Oh, weirdly in Montana, which very seldom happens, we had a great little dove flurry too, which doesn't often happen, but it just so happened where I happened to be this season. We had it also helps when the landowner plants a bunch of sunflowers.
Yeah.
So, you know, create some food plots, et cetera, for the birds. So yeah, we actually had quite a fun, dove shoots, on an evening. So I was kind of Montana and then God, what did I do? Then I kind of came home and then I was hunting. We had the last 2 years in the valley have not been very good quail chucker wise. And this year it was, they were up. The numbers were up for sure. So that was nice.
What are the main influences on birds there? Is it water?
Water and weather at the right time, just like any game bird.
Like,
you know,
right.
Yeah, you could have the right, you know, you could have a pile of rain, but it could be at the wrong time. People forget that,
no.
I think. So they might be like, oh my God, it rained a ton, but it was, they got the rain at the wrong time during the hatch where, you know, you got these little puffballs running around just getting drowned. You know, they can't survive because they just don't have the kind of wax on their feathers yet to kind of repel water, etc. So we had a huge winter last year and I think that kind of helped and just made a lot of things green. And yeah, and birds go in cycles, you know, typically it seems game birds kind of go up and down in cycles and things like that. So yeah, we just hopefully, I wouldn't say it was a phenomenal year, but it was significantly better than the last few years. And I travel a lot to wing shoot too. Mainly, you know, Nevada's not that far away from me. And so where I am kind of geographically located to get to Nevada, I'm normally in the middle of nowhere and I don't, you know, I just don't really see anyone.
That's good.
Yeah, for sure. I enjoy that element of it. But yeah, just chucker and quail at home. Some ducks, not a ton. The flyway we have around here is kind of blur, but it's we had a good duck year just due to all the ponds and water that were made. So
So when you go shoot ducks, are you sneaking out and sitting in some grass with one of your cockers? And
I'm hideous at calling. Like, if you invite me to go and sit in a blind, I'm not going to be the guy grabbing on the reefing on the making the noise and anything. Nothing like that. No. And also, I just get itchy feet. I'm not very good at sitting still.
Yeah.
So I'd rather walk the river and try and jump shoot a couple of ducks. And sometimes you walk out with a couple, and sometimes it's just a nice walk with a gun for 30 minutes or something. I don't put a ton of effort into it. I'm more of an opportunist, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's
And then I swung, and then on my way to Texas, I stopped in Arizona on my way, and my wife's family in that area, so I kind of stopped in Arizona and New Mexico and hunted just for a couple of days here and there, just on some desert quail, before going to Texas. So that was, I didn't really I traveled, but it wasn't necessarily I wasn't chasing down a ton of different species. You know, I wasn't like, oh, I gotta go to this state to try and get this bird. It was more conducive to where are nice bird numbers, so to speak, that we can get some good bird contacts done with the dogs. So that was kind of my season in a nutshell, I guess.
That's a good bit of variety, though, and it sounds like it was kind of at your own pace, which is nice.
Yeah, for a change. It was good.
How does your season break? And how much are you hunting for yourself, and how much are you guiding? Do you feel like you've got a good mix of both right now?
I honestly this past season I had a bit of a shift in some things, and I was doing a lot less guiding and a lot more kind of training. And I'm very fortunate that I have some fantastic clients who put dogs with me for training, and they value, you know, they understand the value of that. They see the value in that. And so that kind of, that made things a little easier. I just wanted to take, I wanted to take a step back from guiding. I was feeling a little burnt out on it. I did things for me a little bit, which was nice. Sometimes it's good to do. It's also, you realize that the grass isn't always greener, and perhaps, you know, like, oh, one, you know, you thought about one thing, but it didn't quite turn out as you thought it would. And so, you know, you might end up going back to something, and which is good. It's good to, you never know unless you don't, you know, unless you try. So, this season I did a lot more hunting for myself, way more hunting for myself. And it was really, which gave me an opportunity to focus on the dogs a lot more. And so the dogs I did have in for training through clients just got, I noticed a huge difference in their kind of, a big difference in their performance, et cetera, because I could just give them time, quite frankly. You know, I was able to give them a lot of time because I wasn't guiding. So it didn't kind of pull me away where I needed, like, oh, I'm guiding today, I need my A string of dogs. You know, it's like, you know, the beautiful thing was I was able to kind of, I had a happy meal. I still did some guiding, but it just wasn't nearly as intense as it has been in years past, which was, honestly, it was nice.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, when you mentioned you had 30 dogs with you down in Texas, some of those are yours, some are client dogs?
Correct. Yeah. I have a sort of a, It's a funny balance between your own dogs and client dogs, because you need, we don't need, but I like to have a certain amount of personal dogs in order to be able to guide, or I have a string of field trial dogs, etc., spaniels, and a sort of a kind of a breeding program, I guess. I don't breed a lot, but when I do, I'd like to have that option, I guess. And so you want to have really good females, or females you think that are good, obviously.
Yeah.
So that, you know, puts you in a certain category of, you know, there's definitely a happy medium of how many personal dogs versus how many client dogs. So I had a nice, I kind of have, had a nice, mixture of both, put it that way. So I think I had like 15 pointing dogs and 15 spaniels, and you know, most of those pointing dogs they'd already been through either the client had done it or my puppy program. So already kind of, you know, the dogs didn't need pigeons in launchers and, you know, blank guns and things like that. They were, it was more of a, this dog needs exposure to wild birds. And, you know, for the most part, there's obviously a lot more to it, goes into it than this. But for the most part, all you got to do is drive somewhere, throw a collar on the dog and cut it loose and try and get it into some birds. It's pretty, you know, self-explanatory like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's some handling. You know, you got to handle the dogs. You have to, you know, handle the dogs whilst they're running. You also have to then decide, you know, you have to make a decision when they do get around birds. Did that dog punch them? Did it take them for a ride? Did it rip the covey? Did it point the birds? How did it point the birds? You know, when you got near the bird, you know, near the dog, did the dog then creep forward and produce the birds? How, you know, there's a whole host of different things to kind of follow on from that. But in essence, it sounds like a lot, but I guess a lot, but really, it's like a perfect number, really very manageable. Yes. And because they don't, you know, they're like athletes, really. They can't be, I mean, you can put them on the ground every day, but are you getting quality results every time? That's the difference. It's like, sure, they can run on the ground every day, but if they go on, you know, say they ran for 2 or 3 hours every single day of the week, but they only found birds one day of the week. You got to then think, why did that dog find birds that one day of the week? Was it because he never got to run in a good place where he had the opportunity to find birds? Maybe the dog's not a good bird finder. Maybe does that make sense? So it's not, I think it's sort of inconducive maybe, but so you got to think about it a bit more tactfully and go like, okay, this dog needs to run on the ground. He needs to, you know, we need to try and get him into some birds, hopefully. Where are we going to go? How are we going to go about that?
Yeah.
So it's a bit more calculated, if that makes sense.
The other thing I forgot to add, I know you got the Cocker Spaniels. What are your pointing dogs? Do you have a mix? Do you got all pointers, setters? I thought you had setters, but.
Yeah, I did. I used to have a whole pile of setters.
Used to.
That's all I had. Yeah, used to. Yeah, I had a whole pile of setters, and then as time has gone on, I don't own any setters anymore. I just have pointers, English pointers. I run English pointers, and that's just through some trial, some error, and I think the personalities typically of those dogs just seem to suit me, and. I've owned some amazing setters. I've seen some great setters. I'm not like an anti-setter guy whatsoever. I just know what I need, and an English pointer for the most part provides that for me anyway. And that's, you know, and it's to put it into some perspective, and this is obviously broad statements, but when I get a young English pointer in for training or something like that, and it needs to go through the basics, bird intro, e-collar intro, gun intro, typically you can get all of those things done with a pointer in about 6 weeks on average. With a setter, that seems to take, you know, that's normally an 8 week, 8 to 10 week process. And then anything outside of that can be 12 weeks and beyond. And that's just been my experience. That's not like, you know, if a German wire hair, for instance, did that, you know, quickly, I'd be like, cool, I'm going to own a bunch of wire hairs. You know what I mean? It's not, I don't have a, you know, like I said, I've owned some great setters. I just found that pointers, for whatever reason, they just work for me. And that's the long and the short of it. And there's certain lines I'm within that, but I'm not biased to them in terms of like lines. I know there's some guys who get real hung up on certain lines of pointers and stuff like that. I've got all sorts of flavors in the kennel, you know.
Yeah.
And I've owned a lot. I've sold quite a lot of started dogs as well, and not just because and I think there's a misconception with the started dog too is. Just because you're selling it doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that it didn't suit me for whatever reason, or you thought it would be potentially better off in the hands of somebody else, that they could get almost more out of it. I just sold a 7-year-old dog to some family friends of my wife's who were looking for their first bird dog. The guy, Ben, great guy, has been on the phone to me, you know, calling me every week, asking me about a million questions. And I got thinking about it and I was like, hey, man, what you really need is just an older dog, you know, to get your foot in the door with this upland hunting thing. You need an older dog that you don't have to worry about, that all you have to do is throw the collar on it. It knows what to do. And so I sold him an older dog of mine. And so far, you know, he's had it for a month now, I think. And, you know, he's like, oh, the dog's great. You know, he called me the other day and asked me a couple of questions. And then the one thing I was like, well, how's she getting on? You know, and he's like, oh my God, the kids love her and this and that. And she probably feels like she's hit the jackpot, you know. And but he's like, you know, his biggest complaint was the fact that she couldn't handle the hardwood floors and she was terrified of them. And I was like, well, Ben, if that's your biggest complaint, that's pretty good. I'm pretty good with that. You know, that's not a bad thing. So
what's your pro tip for, cause I've heard of, I haven't had that issue, but what's your pro tip for getting a dog over different floor surfaces? Just let him figure it out.
Oh God, that's a really hard one for me to answer because, you know, all of my dogs are, you know, essentially they're kennel dogs. So I don't, I am the wrong person to be asking that question. I don't know. I just probably stick them in the middle. You know, if I was like, oh, this dog's nervous, and just, I'd put them in the middle of the damn thing and just, you know, let them freak out and figure it out for a, you know, just stick them in the middle every day or something, or feed them in the middle of there every
day.
Sure.
So
they just have to deal with it. Eventually they're dogs. They adapt. Right. They're very adaptable animals. They get over it fairly quickly, I think, for the most part. So, yeah, hopefully that answers that question. But yeah, I guess back to your, I own a string of pointers. I have some males, some females. I don't think, apart from the visual thing we talked about in the other podcast, I don't think there's much difference in, you know, people, guys are like, well, males versus females. I think that's just a personal preference. And I think that's just the personality of a dog, really. Some guys like male dogs, some guys like female dogs. I just like to me, it's about the personality of the dog. Does the dog have a good personality and does it like to find birds? Pretty much. I mean, it's quite black and white like that. And so I don't kind of buy into the whole male versus female, that kind of thing. I think I currently own both amazing females and male dogs that do a great job. So I think that's more of a personal preference type thing.
When you were talking to me, we were chatting last week and you mentioned that Mike was sort of highlighting the visual nature of the females. That definitely, you know, with Rose, like I think about it more like just her in the backyard. I mean, she'll go out there and stare at squirrels and rabbits and she's just very, very keyed in on anything moving around. Whereas Hartley, my male setter, is a little more carefree about that sort of stuff. And I don't know how much it translates to the field for Rose, but it was definitely, in my small sample size, it definitely sort of rung true, at least in some scenarios.
Yeah, and those are young dog things. I mean, I think if you took two, 3 or 4-year-old dogs, a male and a female, I'm going to get this wrong and somebody will correct me, I'm sure, but there was some studies done on males and females. I think Texas A&M may have did it. And they basically, you know, had dogs and they monitored them for 5 years, males and females. And they basically found, you know, zero, you know, they basically, it wasn't like, oh, well, the males find 80% of the birds and the females only find 20%. They were like right there, neck and neck. And so I think it's just a more of an earlier development thing, perhaps. And I think the attitude of the dog, does the dog have that attitude of like, it's got that grit that it wants to go out and find birds? I mean, that's really the takeaway.
Yeah, does the drive outweigh some of that stuff? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Does the dog possess drive and desire? And if the answer is yes, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I just found with setters that they were a bit more, I already deal with finicky dogs. I have cockers. and I just felt that, I could just teach a concept to a pointer easier and they would understand it. They would understand the concept quicker and move through and develop just that much faster than a setter, and they didn't. Yeah. My dogs are kenneled. I'm probably going to get, you know, people are going to probably be like, "Oh, you're an idiot," you know. But that setters bark. I mean, oh my god, I got fed up with the barking and their kennel manners, etc. And I'm not. I've had some pointers that would eat a barrel in every 2 months and things like that. So don't get me wrong. I've dealt with all sorts of different kinds of, you know, English pointers that were complete nutcases and bouncing off the walls. Absolutely, I have. But you know, you just find some lines that you like, find some breeders that you enjoy dealing with, and you know, for the most part, I kind of know my lane, if that makes sense, with the pointing dogs, and I kind of stay within those parameters. Every now and then, I'll try something new, but that's really the nuts and the bolts of it.
Well, yeah. A lot of what you're saying sounds pretty similar to some of the stuff that my buddy Jerry Havel will say about pointers and setters, and I've heard that stuff before. I mean, like you said, you can find examples in any breed, but you see some tendencies. And I think, like, if I was looking at my dog, I mean, just if I was guiding and had a bunch of dogs, think about some little things with my setters. I mean, my setters have pretty short trim coats, but you know, they'll still get burrs and stuff. And thinking about the stuff that a guide has to do at the end of every day, short haired dogs, pointers, GSPs, that's, you know, a lot lower maintenance in some of those ways. And then I think setters are, and it's one of the things that I like about them, being a guy that just has a couple dogs, you know, the sort of the quirky nature of setters and their personality, if you will. But I could definitely see what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me, I guess.
I also think it depends on what, another misconception is, like, what bird you hunt the most, or where you hunt the most. And I think that gets overlooked a little bit. And then the other classic thing is, like, my buddy has this amazing blur, whatever that is. And so I'm going to get one of those, and I'm going to buy it from the same, like, he's a hell of a bird dog. And it's like, okay, so out of your four friends, that one friend has the best one, and that just happens to be that breeder dog, and he got it from, you know, Dave up the road. So you go and get it from Dave, you know, you go get the same breed from Dave up the road, and then that doesn't turn out to be the same as your friend has. You know, so it's like little things like that. But I think if I was, it's like matching the dog to the, you know, to what you're, you know, say I was really into duck hunting, I probably wouldn't own a bunch of English pointers.
You know, probably not.
Like, I would probably have, you know, I'd probably have a bunch of black labs. And the reason I would have a bunch of black labs is because statistically, if you look at all of the hunt tests and all the retriever world stuff, those, you know, black labs statistically are the most winning, so to speak. So it's just like, why wouldn't you put the ball in your court? It's like, the reason I own English pointers, whatever you want to call them. The reason I own pointers is because
you call
all the major field. Yeah, I just don't really care too much. I just don't get. I don't need. Don't
Where, what need is to get the, a in my bonnet, what's the politically I, correct it, way to say it right now? Pointers only, right?
Oh, I just don't really care. It's just a tail, okay. You know, it's got a tongue and a head on it. I don't know. It runs. Right. I just normally refer to them as pointers, but people then think of like DSPs or something like that.
All so sorts just, of stuff.
So it's just, I typically refer to them as pointers. But if you look at AIMS, you know, or you look at all the major field trials, horseback field trials, shooting dog field trials, and those walking trials, there's that MBHA stuff. You will see that, you know, the cream always rises to the top, and most of the dogs, not always, obviously there are exceptions within the breeds, but most of those dogs that are winning, most of them are pointers.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the breeds are kind of filling in the gaps, but most of them are pointers. And so that's the reason why I own pointers, is because, you know, when you go and you look at who's winning and who's placing in those trials, you go, oh, okay, well, that was pointers. You know, and so that's what I do. Now, if all I did was hunt rough grouse, I would probably potentially own a couple more setters. You know what I mean? Just because they handle the cold better. They seem, if you look at a lot of those, you know, I look at, oh, let's look at the cover dog trials. Let's see what breed of dog is, you know, let's see who's winning and what breed of dog is winning and what line of dog is winning. And that should maybe steer you in a direction of what breed to get potentially, if that makes any sense. Like, I just like to try and put the ball in my court a little bit. It's like, you know, that's how I look at that stuff, I guess. I go, okay, well, where do I want to run? Like, what kind of birds do I run a lot on? What, you know, that's really it. Yeah. So I know around me anyway, a lot of guys, you know, chucker hunters and stuff, they like their GSPs, they like their wire hairs and things like that, which I think is great too. They obviously are a more versatile dog, and they have a way better retrieve drive typically than most pointers. And that's great. That's okay. You know, I'm not going to fight you on that. But if just for out and out, you know, for a performance animal, and for what I do and the birds I choose to pursue, a pointer fits that mold the best. I think that's all I can say about that, really, in the kind of the, and that's just been my experience. A good friend of mine, Rob Jones, he runs setters. He loves setters. That's all he runs. And he runs on, you know, he basically hunts similar birds to myself. So they take that for what you will.
As you pointed out, like, I think there is a lot of, like, a lot of broad strokes get painted, and there's a lot of N of one sample size stuff. And specifically for someone like myself, who, like you pointed out, you know, like, you know, realistically, unless I get into something else or something, like, you know, how many dogs am I actually going to have? It's easy to get carried away. And then it's this long-term commitment. So it's like you go out, you make a decision one day, and then you have a dog for 10 years if you're lucky. And then over the course of a lifetime, it's not all that many. So to pay attention to the things that you pointed out, like all of the labs that there are and all of the pointers and then all of the setters in the grouse woods. You know, I didn't get setters because of their known association with the grouse woods. I kind of learned that after the fact, to be honest. I always say I stumbled into setters, but I feel fortunate in stumbling into them because I wound up with the right dogs for what I do. So all that said, I think it's worth noting that don't ignore the numbers and those large sample sizes of labs, setters, pointers, or whatever it is that you're looking at. There's probably there for a reason. And then within those large sample sizes, you've got all the variety and outliers and examples that we talked about.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm more of a logical thinker and a numbers kind of guy. It's just like, okay, so what dog is producing, what breed of dog is, are these guys running in these certain areas? That's probably what I'm going to get. You know, it's pretty straightforward. Like, you don't see too many, Brocco Italianos, you know, running in those horseback field trials, put it that way.
Yeah.
There's probably a reason I don't own one of those, you know. That's not to say they're not a great dog. We don't need to kind of go down that road. But
it's like, too, like, if you're going to go against the grain and do something different, just accept that and know that you might run into some things that a vast majority of folks might not be dealing with.
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah, I guess that's just how I look at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly that. Yeah, for sure.
All right, yep. Back to birds. Let's go back to birds. I said I wanted to talk to you about forest. I get asked all the time, and obviously I have no experience really hunting forest grouse. And if I recall, like, chatting with you, gosh, I don't know if it was a year or two ago, but you kind of, like, you're out in Montana and you're sort of guiding and you're doing the sharptail hunt stuff that everybody wants to do. And then it was like you were kind of telling me, like, you'd go up and hunt forest grouse, ruffs and blues, kind of for fun, like, on your own time. Is that, like, am I remembering that correctly?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a pretty, all the time. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, tell me a little bit about sort of your forest grouse hunting, like, where you would go, what were you looking for? How you'd find them?
So Montana has, they have a few different species of grouse, rough grouse, blue grouse, Franklin's, a black looking fella.
Which is like a spruce grouse.
Yeah, like a spruce. Yeah. I'm not too.
If I'm wrong about that, my friend Bailey will kill
okay,
me.
Okay, she'll get you on it.
I don't think I am.
But the yeah, so I would just the area geographically was I was in was more rough grouse and blue grouse, and yeah. So that's really what I did. And the one of the couple of different reasons for kind of going sort of pursuing them is I could run the, especially in early season when it was hot, is I could wake up early, run the pointing dogs in the morning on prairie birds, and then you could then, you know, have a little siesta, and then in the afternoon you could drive up into the forest and be in the nice cool woods and chase. And typically when you're in those forests, you're, especially if you're kind of looking for rough grouse, you're walking up a little creek, you know, something yeah. that's maybe a foot wide or something like that. So the dogs can always get into water. They can have a drink. They can cool off if they need to. They're not, the chances of them overheating are significantly less. And so I would normally park, just try and park in an area and then that had a couple of different kind of different options, different creeks, different streams going off from it. And then I would normally take one or two dogs, depending on kind of the age and the situation with the dogs. And we would just do a little, you know, just maybe an hour loop or something like that with them. And you would take and I would sort of stick to the stream for the most part. And then at certain areas you would, you know, say there was little openings or certain areas where you would think that there was, especially if you saw a ton of food out there, you know, you'd kind of cruise over to those little areas and hunt those areas. And it's just, for me anyway, early season with the flushing dogs, I had so much, I just have a lot of fun doing that. It gets them in and around birds. You often are hitting that time of year, you're typically not, you're getting into broods of them. So you're flushing, you know, you might get like, you might flush one or two, or then some, you know, five or six get up, or, you know, that kind of thing. So there's more broods, there's more options, and it just variety is the spice of life, perhaps. And it's just you go from pointing dogs all the time, you know, zipping around, to then it just gives you something different to kind of switch and target at. But I mean, in terms of like finding them and things like that, I would say you know, grab a map, find some forests, find, you know,
but those creeks, those drainages, I think that's what comes to mind for me.
Totally, yeah. Find creeks, find drainages. That's really where they're going to be. Especially, I should be more specific, especially rough grouse. Now, this is for rough grouse. That's what I would do. I would find small streams, creeks, things like that, and I would walk up them for rough grouse, which is mostly what I targeted, just because I had a lot of fun with the spaniels with them. And then your mountain grouse, kind of the blue grouse, you're gonna be in a similar area. There was definitely some crossover, but you're gonna be up in higher elevation. You're going to be more in what I would call like elk country. You know, if you looked at something, you went, oh, I think, you know, that looks like elk would live up there. Probably blue grouse are going to live up there. A very atypical thing would be a big mountain range. You could drive a logging road up for a ways and then, you know, walk an old logging road and get out onto some of those big, more open faces, open benches, mm-hmm. and big meadows, especially if it had trees below it, because the birds, you know, if you find them, they're going to fly basically directly off that slope into the trees. And so that's really an ideal setup for blue grouse. But I would say, yeah, that's kind of those rough grouse. The rough grouse definitely kind of captured my attention a lot more, to so much so that I think this year I have to take a trip to the kind of to the true grouse woods to chase rough grouse and woodcock.
You could maybe get yourself into trouble depending on what, you know, true grouse, what some people might say New England, but
I know that's, say, yeah, I know. I can't wait to put
others the, would say Appalachians. I might say the Great Lakes, but yeah, yeah. The non-Western grouse woods is what you're meaning.
Correct. Yeah. Let's not, yeah. You know, yeah. If somebody wants to educate me on what the true grouse woods are, I'm all ears, but, yeah, just go somewhere that's basically more conducive to finding that particular bird.
See is what really all the fuss is about.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So yeah, I'd like to go to the Northwoods, if you will.
Yeah.
There you go. You know, traipse around and try and find some rough grouse and some woodcock, I think. And it would be.
Have you ever hunted woodcock or probably not?
No.
Okay.
No, I've not actually. No. Nope. So I'd like to experience that, and I'm really excited to experience it with the spaniels. I'm sure my pointing dogs are going to do fine. I suspect I'm going to be duct taping their tails because they'll probably all explode on every tree that they whack. But it's just coming from England. And knowing what it's like hunting back home and the cover and the kind of, you know, and that sort of thing. And then seeing the grouse woods, I'm like, oh, that's sort of a bit more reminiscent of my, you know, hunting styles back in England. And so I'm really excited to take the spaniels there and run the spaniels through those woods and see, and just see what it's like. It could be terrible. I could hate it, but I've got an inkling that I probably won't, due to the fact that I love to, you know, especially early season in Montana, I really enjoy going up into the woods and poking around in the woods around there. It's just a different feel. The woods just have a different feel too. It's not, the prairies are beautiful, obviously. They're wide open expanses, etc. But me personally, I just like the kind of more mountainy, kind of woody kind of areas. I mean, the horses for courses, right? There are people that love that Arizona desert and cactuses and sororas everywhere. My wife grew up there, and that's what she loves. And I'm almost like, I'd rather be in the woods in the mountains kind of thing. But that's just me.
Well, I'm excited for you. I think you're gonna have a good time, and we'll definitely keep in touch if you swing through here. I would love to. It would give me an excuse to finally get out and chase some grouse with some more flushing dogs, so I can stop saying I've hardly ever done it before. So that would be fun, and I could show you where some grouse live in the Northwoods. One thing you did mention, food, when you were talking forest grouse out west, and I guess at this point I've talked to enough people and read about like blue grouse hunting enough to, it's like those open benches and plains, like that's what I picture. And you know, if we're talking early season, I think grouse are very much, you know, lots of insects around those openings and stuff. But what kind of food are you finding in the drainages and stuff? Like, I feel like I've heard Andy Wayman, when I interviewed him, talking about sort of mountain ash trees, like choke cherry, maybe like service berry. What do you find in those drainages as far as food?
Yeah, actually, exactly what he said. That's where he's down in Idaho, I believe.
Yep.
Where it's not too dissimilar. Exactly those things.
Good. That my memory serves me.
you have a good memory. Yeah, that's exactly those, and they like that. You know, they do like an aspen thicket sort of thing. They do a little bit later on in the year. They like that aspen a bit more, it seems. But they'll be down in there, and they just like that edge. You know, they're in that, you know this from hunting rust grouse. They just like that edge kind of cover, especially right in the bottom there. That's kind of I think you pretty much covered it with the food source. The biggest thing I actually look at is drainages is a water source. Honestly, I'm more drawn to a water source than I am a food source when it comes to kind of rough grouse in the mountains, I guess. Yeah,
you know, that's that idea has arisen for me as far as like I feel like I almost sort of didn't realize it, but that is kind of the most important thing to me as well, some sort of water source. And I notice it specifically hunting drier areas. You know, I grew up hunting very, very swampy grouse country, whereas now I hunt some areas that are not so wet. And the water source, the importance of that, and I think sort of the way I frame it now is grouse, I mean, they are an opportunistic feeder. They're going to eat stuff that they find, and they're going to go where the food is. And so the water source just seems to be sort of the common denominator, if you will. That'd be the best way to put it, so that you find that water source, you work that water source, and whatever food sources in and around it, the birds are going to be there because there's just more biodiversity there. There's a higher abundance of food. And I find myself seeking out those water sources more than, and the cover around them more than anything else.
Yeah, and I think the rough grouse, especially in that kind of more mountainous terrain, that's really the only option where the food is kind of growing anyway, is around those water sources. And it's honestly hard early. It's way harder, as you know this too. It was a lot harder early in the season because of all the leaves on the trees. And so that's mostly when I'm in there. So I'll hear a lot more flushing than I will actually seeing a bird. And then I just have a little thing. A lot of those birds are pretty ditzy that time of year. So they'll flush and they'll literally flit up into the tree, and you could almost poke out of the tree with the barrel of your gun if you wanted to. And honestly, I just leave those guys alone and I move on, and hopefully, they plop back down in the cover, and then I'm maybe on my way down the hill, especially if I have a young dog that needs to get into a few birds, we might go and hit that area again. And just to get a bird contact, I think that's the other misconception, is I might run and train with the dogs on there, but I don't need to shoot a pile of birds. That's not the object. That's not the goal. Yeah. It's the hunting and the bird contacts. And it's like, you can only shoot three. And so I might only need to harvest one or two or something like that.
Yeah.
And you just know early season too, you end up shooting your gun probably a lot more than you actually get a retrieve. I definitely have a management aspect there too, where I'm just like, I don't need to, for whatever reason, I don't need to try and shoot at that bird. That's just how I look at that stuff, because I'd like to maybe go back in that area in a week's time, or go to a similar drainage, and that bird, I don't necessarily know the sort of how far they migrate and travel, but it could be like, that bird is in this drainage. Well, that drainage links up to this one, so maybe, there's a crossover there. So that's just kind of how it, that's just, that's how I think about it anyhow.
Yeah. All right. Segueing a little bit, but you started chasing more ruffed grouse, and then all of a sudden you decided you needed to do a gun fitting. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I've been trying to, back in England, when you go to buy a shotgun, at least when I was growing up as a kid, you went to the gun store and there was always a guy, you always got a gun fitting, either at the store, or you went and saw some old boy down the road or whatever who did a gun fitting for you, who had a tri gun and you'd shoot a patent plate, etc. And then you go and order your gun. Being in the States, that it's really hard. It's really desperate, really difficult thing to find. Not many people do it, and not many people do it that well. And so, to me, a gun fitting is really important because I am not the average size human. I'm like 6'1". I've got big, long, gangly arms, a long neck, and I shoot off my left shoulder. And so most guns that are off the peg gun doesn't fit me, quite frankly. And so something I always struggled with. And so, this year I was in Texas and I contacted you, and you mentioned that there was an older gentleman, Jay Herbert. Is it Herbert?
You got it. Yep.
Yeah. Was in Houston, which wasn't that far away. So I went and visited Jay, had a gun fitting with him. Great experience. I got to, he's got an old Churchill gun that he there was only 12 of them made, and he had number 10, I think, if I remember rightly. Yeah. And so just a really cool experience. And it was kind of annoying because we went through the gun fitting, and then he's just like, the annoying part was, he's like, now you don't have an excuse anymore. And I was like, looked at him, what do you mean? And he's like, well, now you don't have an excuse to miss. Your gun fits you. That's one less excuse. And I'm like, fair enough. And so it was just a great experience, something that I felt was important to do. And I would encourage anybody to get a gun fitting, quite frankly, especially if you're struggling with your shooting. It's like, mostly it's gun fit and poor mounting of the gun. Yeah. And so inconsistent gun mount. Yeah. And at that point I do a bunch of gun fitting on my own guns. I end up buying not a lot, but I buy secondhand guns, and then I kind of, I kind of go to town on them a little bit. And so I got a whole hodgepodge of bits of wood stuck on the ends to lengthen the pull. And I kind of mess around a little bit with another guy, a woodworking friend of mine, to try and do a little bit of bending if possible, stuff like that. So we kind of play around with some stuff, but it's not a great science. Honestly, I wouldn't recommend it to everyone. But I would, however, recommend. You know, the really cool thing about the Upland Gun Company is the fact that they customize these guns for an extremely reasonable price. That's really the deal. I would say on that other note is I got a gun fitting and then I went online. There is a stock manufacturer in Spain. Oh, I'm going to blank on the name now.
I don't remember the name. It's called like the One Click Stock or whatever.
Yeah. So I put in my stock dimensions, and then they gave me a sheet to fill out where I measured my hand and everything. And then they asked you a few other questions about if you want an adjustable comb and this and that. And so I answered those questions. And so I actually have a stock coming from those guys. They're very reasonably priced, and I'm very curious. I'm curious to see how it's going to work out and fit, but it shouldn't be too far off. And that stock is for a very particular gun that I shoot a lot. Right. Especially in spaniel training, and it's basically a sporting clays gun, and I shoot that gun a lot. And so I just wanted something that was more, in theory, I had less excuses, as Jay would say, because apparently this stock should hopefully fit me. And so I went down that road. I'm curious to see how it's going to work out. I'm excited to get that, and that's really the whole gun fitting thing. Is I would encourage anybody to do, say you only had a certain budget, I would almost like spend more of your budget of your gun on the actual gun fitting than the gun itself. I mean, that's really and somebody like Jay, he's been doing it forever. My gun fitting took all of about 30 minutes, I think. And most of that was just chatting and having a conversation about wing shooting. And then on my way home, I stopped in and saw a pseudo legendary spaniel guy by the name of David Jones, who lives kind of in between Houston and where I was, and I kind of visited with him. But that's a whole other story for a different time. But
another day, maybe on your podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. We'll talk about that. But that's really cool. I was happy that you got a chance to go down and shoot with Jay. I've talked to him. I have not met him. I really want to interview him. I kind of was reserving that to like maybe interview him in person if I can get down to Texas one of these days. I have not done that yet, so I might have to give Jay a call one of these days. But you have the unique perspective of you hear that in England, you buy a gun, it's always like fit first. Like what's your fit? And you got to get fit. Whereas that's not how it has been done in America. It's such an out of sight, out of mind afterthought. We go and we buy one off the shelf and we just adapt ourselves to the gun. So obviously with Up and Gun Company, we have absolutely tried to communicate that message and the importance of fit. And I've sort of come to this place where I would absolutely agree with you in that if you're getting sidetracked thinking about, well, geez, I don't want to build a custom gun and spend all that money on a custom gun, forget about that right away. Like the gun fitting is an investment in your wing shooting and your overall experience. Like you cannot go wrong starting there. Go get a gun fitting and at least learn what your stock dimensions are and sort of what your relationship, what kind of stock profile you should be shooting, because you can then take that and apply that to the guns that you already have. You can make adjustments reasonably. You can start there, and I just don't think you can go wrong doing that and making that investment in your wing shooting and the experience, and then, you know, custom gun, maybe that comes down the road at some point, but it doesn't have to be the whole kit and caboodle right from day one.
100%. And I think, you know, when I was with Jay and I was like telling him, I'm like, do you want me to tell you what I'm seeing? And he's like, sure. And I'd mount the gun, shoot. I'm like, okay, well, I'm seeing this part of the barrel and I'm seeing this and I'm seeing that. And I'd tell him all of these things and he'd just look and smile and go, okay, cool. Mount the gun, shoot. Mount the gun, you know, and I would tell him, yep, like, hey, Jay, now I'm seeing this. Now I'm seeing this. And he would just be like, okay, cool. Uh-huh, cool. And he's like, well, he's like, the last, you know, five shots, he's like, you've hit the pattern plate exactly where I wanted you to hit it every single time. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, so it doesn't matter what you're seeing. It doesn't matter what you're doing. He's like, the whole point of it is you mount the gun, you're looking down, you know, you're just looking at the bird in theory. Yep. All you're doing is looking at that target, mount the gun. And when you're, you know, when that stock hits your cheek, you're pulling the trigger. And that's all it is. That's the essence of wing shooting is. Yeah. And so it was so funny how I was like, well, I'm seeing this and I'm doing this and I feel this. And he was just like, cool, man. Yeah, great. Whatever. And he's just like, well, you keep hitting the pattern plate exactly where I want you to hit it. So I don't really care what you're seeing. You know, like what I'm seeing is the end result, which is in theory a dead bird. And I'm like, yeah, cool. Yeah, I was getting way more technical than he was, which is great to then bring it back to. It's just simple. It's just mount the gun, pull the trigger when it feels good. And so I don't know how much down the rabbit hole you want to go, but you can start to get into barrel lengths and chokes and panning your guns and all these other things that I think are somewhat relevant and important too. But yeah.
Yeah.
My
other question would be are you left eye dominant?
No.
So you shoot off the left shoulder, but you're right eye dominant.
No, sorry. That's a complete lie. Other way around. Sorry. I'm right handed, but I'm left eye dominant. So I shoot.
There you go.
So I shoot off my left shoulder because I am left eye dominant. And that was when I was younger, I would shoot off my right shoulder and I was horrible. I'd miss everything and I'd be there, and, you know, in a small pigeon stand in England trying to shoot wood pigeons. And I'd be like, you know, my friends would be killing birds and I'd be like, oh, I'm missing everything. You know, occasionally I'd get lucky and hit one. And as a kid, you'd always be like, oh, this, you know, ooh, you know, Mike's better than me. This sucks. You know, and as time went on, I remember my father took me for a shooting lesson, and immediately the instructor within like, I think 10, you know, 10 shots was just like, let's check your eye dominance. And we did that. And he was like, oh, well, there's a reason you keep doing X, Y, and Z. It's because you're right handed, but you got a couple of options. You can wear the, you know, the silly eye patch. You can do glasses. You can do all these other things. He's like, well, the best thing to do is just learn to shoot off your left shoulder. And so that's pretty much what I did. And it was a bit weird at first, but then after a while, I don't even think about it now. You know, it's just part and parcel of it. So that's just what I do.
Well, good for you, because that really is the number one recommendation from about any gun fitter I've ever spoken to is, you know, that's a hard thing for a lot of people to do, especially if you're much later in life. But if you can do it, that usually seems to be the best recommendation, is just switch to the shoulder where your dominant eye is. So,
yeah. And it really boils down to like, do you want to kill birds or don't you? I'm quite a logical black and white thinker like that. And it's just like, okay, how am I with, and I think people maybe don't understand, maybe realize this, but when you're training and field trialing spaniels, you have to be accurate, but you're also killing those birds. You're not, typically most guys will probably killing a bird. I'm talking, you know, very literal things. You know, they're probably killing a bird within 30 or 40 yards. I would say that if you watch, we are so lucky at field trials. We probably have the best wing shooters, period. Like, I'm not kidding. You go to a spaniel field trial,
you will, especially in national, you will have some of the best wing shooters in the United States at that field trial, bar none. And so when you're training a spaniel, you are letting that bird get out probably further than you typically would when you're just going hunting, because you are trying to get that spaniel to you're trying to maybe have it make a big retrieve, or do you know there are reasons behind it, and so you're letting that bird get out a bit further, so therefore you need to be substantially more accurate, so you need everything you can possibly put in your favor in order to make that a successful shot. So that's kind of that's another kind of reason why I wanted to have a gun fitting, et cetera, is for those reasons, I guess.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, buddy, before we get cut off here again, do you want to tease the podcast and that you've been working on? Let folks know what they could find.
Yeah. So I just in essence, spaniel field trials are kind of dying a little bit. I would love to see a flurry of kind of newer enthusiastic people, young or old. And so I've started a podcast that's extremely niche. It's purely about spaniels, cockers and Springer spaniels, pretty predominantly, and to do with the hunting and field trialing of them. I'm going to try and throw out an episode at least once a month, maybe twice a month if I'm feeling lucky. And I'm going to be interviewing, covering all sorts of, you know, good friend of mine, Jeff Lusk, is probably going to be the first guy. And we're talking about puppy development. Then I've got Rob Barlow, he's going to be talking about all the different disciplines you can, all the different venues you can field trial your spaniel, things like that. And so that's, it's just a fun little project, I think, that will hopefully, just sort of all I want to do is raise awareness and expose spaniels, because I think they're great. I thoroughly enjoy them and I would love to see the sport continue. And if this is a way to make it continue, then great. And luckily I have access and I can speak to, I just have conversations and try and help people. Probably a lot of it's going to be on the sort of a lot of training elements and things like that about, because I think that's where maybe a lot of people maybe struggle or don't understand. Like they have a spaniel and they maybe don't know where to go, or they think they've got a great dog, but they don't know how good it is. And so it's just, anyway, it's just a very niche podcast that maybe, you know, we'll get 10 listeners. But if, you know, a couple of those are new people that get them into the sport, then then it's totally worth it for me.
Hell yeah, buddy. Good on you. I'm happy you're doing it. And I know that my setters and I will have very little to offer your soon to be loyal listeners as a guest. But as I hope it goes without saying, you know, I'm here to help as far as anything podcast goes. And you know that. So I'm excited for you. And I don't know that it's available just yet, but where should folks pay attention to? How do they find it if and when it's ready?
Yeah, it's pretty basic. It's called Spaniels in the Field, and it will be available on all the usual podcast downloading places.
Wherever you listen.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Yep, wherever you listen.
All right, buddy. HeritageGundogs.com for all things Matty Rawlinson and the dogs, at Heritage.Gundogs on Instagram. Anything else you want to let listeners know about?
Sure. Yeah. If you have any dog related questions, yeah. give me a call. Don't be afraid to pick up the phone. I think I'm pretty happy to talk to people. So don't be afraid to, if you've got a question, shoot me a message, give me a call. Don't be afraid to reach out. There's no such thing as a silly question. So I'll be happy to try and answer as many questions come my way. And then, we'll just be cracking on with the field trial season here, and yeah, be just messing around with dogs. Yeah.
Awesome. What's on tap for the rest of the day? Is it too hot to run dogs, or are you heading to the field right after we hang up?
no, actually, I got to go to the vet and take some dogs to the vet to get their eye. All the Cocker Spaniels and Springer Spaniels are in for an eye appointment today to make sure they just an eye test thing. It's just good to have with these breeds. And so go to the vet, deal with that. And then, we're just gearing up. We have a field trial next week in Washington. And so I will be out there training the dogs and running some dogs and putting some birds out there for them. Just another day at the kennel. Yep.
Excellent, buddy. Well, it was great to catch up with you. As always, keep up the great work, my friend. And thank you for joining me for another episode of the Bird Chat Podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Nick.
All right. Hang with me for just a second. That does it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.